are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
For me, every single day you spend with students and that moment when you see recognition in their eyes that you've helped them move forward, learn something significant or develop, always are the energy drivers.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Richard Gerver, speaker, author, and former primary and head teacher. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing how Richard fell in love with teaching, what he means by a culture of assumed excellence, and exploring why creating opportunities for self-leadership in schools is so important.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I am having a conversation with Richard Gerver. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Ross. How are you?
I'm good. Could you introduce yourself to listeners and tell everyone what you do, please?
Yeah, sure. So I was a primary school teacher and then a primary head teacher for 16 years until I left that frontline world of education just over a decade ago. We might come on to the reasons why and what happened in more detail since. But it led me to an opportunity to take up a life traveling around the world, speaking about education, around leadership, around change, around human development, and also gave me the opportunity to write books about the things in those areas that really gripped and interested me, which brings me to where I am today and chatting to you about one of those latest books.
And the title of the latest book?
Is Education a Manifesto for Change.
Okay, I'm pretending I don't know. Obviously, I know your work very well, but for listeners that don't know you, could you describe your education background and maybe how you got into primary teaching, that moment when you took on headship?
Yeah, well, going all the way back, the reason I'm laughing is I wish I could tell you it was some profound passion that had driven me since childhood to become a teacher. I actually, all those years ago when I left school, wanted to work as an actor or at least in theatre and the arts and tried it for a while until I realised there was an essential flaw to my plan, which was that I was rubbish. So I went to college, and it was a college in those days in Derbyshire, Derby. It's now a university. And was doing a combined studies degree, and in the first year of my degree met a young woman who I fell head over heels for, who was training to be a primary school teacher.
Yeah, well, there you go.
It's extraordinary how these things change your life, right? Anyway, and after a couple of dates, I did that thing which most shallow young men do, which was feign real interest in, you know, her developing career as a student. And I said, you know, amazing that you want to be a teacher. She called my bluff and got me into her school to do drama with her kids. And I absolutely, it's one of those weird moments.
That was her plan anyway.
Well, yeah, right. And I fell in love with teaching. You know, it was one of those moments where you suddenly just find yourself in a place where you think, why has this never been on my radar? And actually, that first time in my evolving life that I truly found myself somewhere I belonged. Anyway, it must have worked because I finished my degree, did a PGCE, became a primary school teacher.
Yeah.
And all these years later, that young woman has been my wife and we've raised a family together. So, yeah, kismet in many ways, I guess. And most of my teaching career was like that. You know, I never had a hyper plan. I was never one of those professionals that went.
So what point did the headship conversation start?
Well, I mean, that really started to come whilst I'd been a deputy head and had been seconded by a local authority to develop some programs for demotivated boys, particularly, to try and encourage them into reading and writing. And as part of that program, I was encouraged to visit a number of schools to try and get them on board with the program in the local authority. And hadn't really thought about headship at all at that point. In if I'm honest, I've regarded the secondment to the local authority as a bit of a sabbatical, you know, under the immense pressure that you feel as a teacher and then as a school leader, just to get a bit of time to breathe, to see stuff from a different angle. But walked into one of these schools, and it's becoming a bit of a theme. Instantly fell in love with the place. Yeah. It hadn't had a head for a very long time, 18 months actually since its last permanent head. It had had something crazy like 8 heads in 10 years. And I can't explain it to you, Ross. I fell in love with the place. I fell in love with the kids, the staff, the buildings.
And how many years were you a head teacher there for?
I was a head teacher there for 7 years. So okay. Applied for the job, got it because I was the only applicant, and was lucky enough to spend 7 years there as the head teacher.
So what would be your number one tip for people considering getting into teaching? What would be your piece of advice?
I think my number one tip for anyone considering getting into teaching is please don't be put off by the dark things you hear at the moment, because they're there. I mean, they've always been there. I think they're more amplified now than they ever have been in my career for various reasons. But, you know, for me, every single day you spend with students and that moment when you see recognition in their eyes that you've helped them move forward, learn something significant or develop, always are the energy drivers. And I would say to people wanting to go into teaching, give it a go, move forward, because I won't pretend to you that it's an easy job, that it's all rainbows or unicorns, because it certainly isn't. But I'm sure, like you, Ross, those moments and memories of being in the classroom with the students are the things that will carry me through the rest of my days.
Oh, yeah. And then your top tip for wanting to be a head teacher?
Oh, God.
Because I didn't quite take that step. So what would be your advice?
For me, it's knowing in your mind that you have the courage to stand by your convictions, because that courage is going to be tested severely.
Yeah.
And many of us, you know, when we're in positions of assistant headship or deputy headship, I think often look at the people above us in the chain and occasionally get frustrated with the way they're making decisions and acting. And I think that's the first sign that you're on your way to being ready. But the major step is knowing that you could stand in those shoes and have the courage of your convictions under the pressure of, be it from Ofsted, be it from a governing body, be it from any other field, that you have the courage to stand by those convictions, because it's that kind of mental strength that you're going to need to make a significant difference as a head teacher.
So let's flip the coin. Let's say I've taken your advice, I've done teaching 5, 6, 7 years, and I'm now considering leaving. What would be your bit of advice to make me stick in it with it for another half a term or a year? What would be your bit of wisdom there?
I think the really important thing for me is this, and I look back on my own time when I left, you know, like so many people who have lived within the sphere for as long as you have, there was an element of this is going to be extraordinarily exciting because I'm no longer going to have responsibility for so many things. A lot of the pressures will come off my shoulders. But I want people to think very hard about what they'll miss, because when I look back, and even now, a decade on, the things I miss most are twofold, really. One is the energy I got from the students I was lucky enough to teach. And the second was actually the camaraderie. Mm. You know, I think we take for granted so often the really good things that happen to us in school. And I think that camaraderie of being with a team of people who are often more than just colleagues is a significant thing for me. And so I would urge people to make sure they're ready for that, because I think it's something that I still live with as a regret.
Yeah, I would say I probably deeply miss that.
Yeah,
those friendship circles. Let's go on to workload, or not specifically workload just yet. If I could focus on one thing, what would you like to see change in education?
For me, I think the biggest thing is that we need to create an environment in education that I call the assumption of excellence. We have to trust the profession. We have to trust teachers more. We have to assume rightly that the vast, vast majority of people working in our schools are desperate to do the right things for the students in their care. And that means if we can start to move towards that model, we stop living in a system where you're guilty until proven innocent, which is very much the way I think the education system is at the moment. And I think hampers so much of the opportunity for teachers to experience professional joy. And also it undermines their sense of well-being and feeling of being a passionate
My thought is, imagine if our teachers were trusted and funded, what we could achieve.
Do you know, I mean, it's truly remarkable, isn't it? And don't get me wrong, I'm not going to try and be divisive here, but I've often said, because I've always worked in the state system, I've always said that if I had the head funding of a top private school and the staff I worked with in the state system, the things we could achieve would be truly remarkable for kids in areas of social deprivation and challenge.
Yeah. What's your favourite part of working with different schools?
For me, it's the learning. I mean, I don't know about you. I mean, for A, it's an extraordinary privilege to be invited in to spend time in other people's schools. And I think it's a privilege, sadly, that most teachers don't get afforded. You know, an opportunity to see different contexts, to see the way different people work. Because the danger of working in your own school and the intensity of that is you always think your problems are unique and then your school must be tougher or more challenging than others. Yeah. And I think that opportunity to visit, to see, to sample, to work with, to talk to other practitioners, to see other students and other schools working is an incredible honour. And the number of times in the last 10 years or so, Ross, that I've walked into a classroom or a school and thought, God, I wish I'd seen that when I was a practitioner because it would have made me a better teacher. Yeah. You know, that privilege of magpieing, I think.
And we need those ideas and being time poor and things, but I don't know, on your travels, workloads, you know, become a huge issue. Obviously, the nature of teaching is always busy. But if it's a problem in schools, on your visits, what would be your best piece of advice that you would give a school leadership team or a teacher based on your insights of what you've seen?
I think the bravest leaders I've seen in schools in anywhere around the world that I've been, actually, and this does sound a bit, you know, unicorny, but it really isn't. It's very powerful. Are the leaders who assess what's going on in terms of process in their schools and say, how does this directly impact on our students? The truth is, those leaders, if they can't find a direct trail to the workload and the direct impact, positive impact, on the students in their schools and their classrooms, then those leadership teams either find ways to modify or scrap the fat, if you like.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's very easy thing to say, but it's an incredibly courageous thing to do as a leadership team. But my God, it's vital. And the thing is, it's possible. You know, one of the things I think that we have to get our heads around as leadership teams in schools is that some of what we think we have to do is a perception problem. I think there is actually more opportunity for us as leadership teams to take drastic action sometimes than we're led to believe. It's often some of those really experienced, savvy and courageous school leadership teams that are the ones that have the courage to make those cuts and decisions.
Yeah.
And I urge school leaders to really make sure that they're not using supposition, but they're being really evidential about how much leeway they have in the decisions they take.
Yeah, I regularly ask about perceptions in my training events, and it, time and time again, it comes back as leadership perception of what people might want. What's your insights from outside of education, on your travels, perhaps people working in business or sport? Any insights there in terms of lessons we can learn about leadership from outside the sector?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one thing that's happening at the moment in both the business world and in the sporting world is an absolute focus on self-leadership. So if you take elite sport, for example, and it's something that was really started in this country by Clive Woodward when he was in charge of the England rugby team that won the World Cup in 2003, was an absolute commitment to change the culture where athletes were relying on coaches to tell them what to do and how to do it. So that reliance culture, and actually to create an environment where athletes themselves were empowered to lead the decisions around so much of their own coaching and development and progress. And I've seen exactly the same thing in some of the most dynamic companies I've been lucky enough to work in, places like Google, for example, which has exactly that same philosophy. It goes back to something I talked about briefly before. They have maturely developed a culture of assumed excellence, where what you do is you transfer responsibility to staff, to athletes, to workers, to teachers, to students. And that doesn't mean you don't hold them to account, but you only hold them to account if they underperform, right? But what you're doing is creating a culture where staff are able to ask the right questions of themselves and each other, and therefore leaders become far more around facilitating that development than being the people who are depended upon. And I think, you know, one of the things for me in our schools is exactly the same thing. We're asking a lot of our school leadership teams, but they need the time and space to lead. And that means we need a teaching force that have the confidence to lead themselves first.
Okay, fascinating. How would you suggest we do that?
I think, the really important thing for me is to, it begins with courage in leadership. It begins with the courage to believe in the people you're employing and have working for you.
Yeah.
But it also requires an unremitting, and this might sound uncomfortable to some, an absolute level of expectation. You know, that we as a culture within our schools, expect excellence and professionalism from all of our staff. We expect them to engage in action research, in developmental work, in collaboration, in broadening their own horizons and understanding, in challenging their own practice. And I think, therefore, you know, this isn't something we can snap our fingers and go, we're going to create that culture, because it does take time to achieve that. But I do think we have to change the level of expectation, both as teachers on our leaders and leaders on our teachers. And if we start to do that, and start to create a really powerful form of self-regulation and accountability, we can actually create a very, very powerful argument to the alternatives of the external accountability systems that are so driving our system and in many ways denigrating our potential.
What's your view on potentially the Chartered College of Teaching perhaps being an organisation where that self-regulation could happen?
I think it's a really significant step forward. I think it's a really great opportunity. But what I think we need are to see the best of us contribute through the stories that are already out there, the practice that's already out there, to how that can be formed. And the other thing I think is really important about that is we must not make the mistake of acting too fast and putting that into place before the context and the environment is right for that process to be there. Otherwise, we can be accused by whoever it might be of, oh, that was just another quick fix that's failed. Mm-hmm. We have to develop a culture of that professional excellence first and then find a way to hold it to account. The problem, I think, in so many aspects of education as it stands at the moment, is we want to see innovation and change in systems and structures, in the way we output and the way we run and design learning. But we always feed into the same outcomes. So systems never truly evolve because they're always just speaking to fixed outcomes. We have to have the courage to evolve a new approach and then find a way to hold it to account.
Okay, I'm going to move on. Thank you for those interesting insights. I'm going to move on to some quick fire questions.
Oh, God.
In the theme of workload, and I want you to reply instinctively if that's possible.
Go on.
Okay, so here we go. What book are you reading?
I am currently reading, I'm reading two books at the moment. I'm reading Leading from the Edge by James Hilton, which is all about dealing with stress and well-being in education, and also a book I was bought for my birthday, which is Speeches That Changed the World.
Okay, and who's that published by?
Oh, gosh, now you're asking. Hold on, let me get it for you off my shelf. Quercus, Q-U-E-R-C-U-S.
Okay. All right, lovely.
Quercus Books.
Wake up in the morning. Are you an orange juice tea or coffee man?
Cranberry and black coffee.
Cranberry and black coffee. And if you had that perfect biscuit to dunk in your coffee, what would it be?
I'd be a chocolate digestive.
Okay. What project are you working on right now?
I am currently working on developing the concepting for my next book, which is going to be called, in working title, Thrive, How to Live a Life of Purpose, Passion and Success.
Okay. If you were a sports person, what would be your sport?
Oh, God, I wish it would be football. I'd love it to be cricket, but I think it's more likely to be something sedate like bowls.
Okay, what's your biggest regret?
My biggest regret is never actually giving myself long enough or the courage to see if I could succeed working as an actor or in the theatre.
Okay. Favourite holiday destination for teachers?
Oh, God. Anywhere that's warm, sunny and by a pool, and preferably somewhere where you're in no danger of somebody coming up to you going, Miss Sir, I can't believe you're here too.
Okay, top thing to do when you're visiting Derby?
Oh, God, definitely come and see me at the cricket club. I'm obsessed with Derbyshire County cricket, and it's a great day out, particularly when the sun's shining.
Okay, somebody you've not met that I could interview next and why?
And they have to be alive, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness me. That's a
so, great... essentially, who would you like to meet?
Oh gosh, that's a really really. I think it would have to be. What's her name? Masala Yousafzai.
Yeah. Okay. And then someone you have met that I should meet.
Oh come on, it's a mic drop moment, Ross. You know what the answer is.
Yeah, well, I can see the picture on your wall.
Yeah, Barack Obama. Just everything you'd want him to be and more. Such a deeply intelligent, humble man who is such an incredible has such an incredible ability to synthesize the complex and make it sound simple.
Okay, lovely. Last question: where can listeners find out more about you online? Plug your book, your blogs, things like that.
Oh, brilliant. Well, they can interact with me through my website, which is just richardgerver.com, on Twitter, which is @RichardGerver. And on my website, they can sign up to my monthly newsletter where they'll get loads of information about what I'm up to, some of my thinking, mm-hmm. and some of the people I get to meet.
And that new book's out now. It's called?
Education, A Manifesto for Change.
Okay, great. Thank you, Richard, for your time. It's been a pleasure catching up with you again.
Thanks.
You're listening to Teacher Toolkit, everyone. You can find out more on teachertoolkit.co.uk. Follow on social media using the hashtag TTKitPodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you again soon. Thanks, Richard.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Ross.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.